Hello, this is Peter Powell. I was at Radio 1 from 1977 to 1988. I was 16 and I remember making an appointment to tune in to listen to the opening show with Tony Blackburn. And the countdown and the whole excitement and the energy of waiting for this brand new network to come on board was quite phenomenal for me. And at 16, I remember sitting there listening to Tony Blackburn doing his first show and going, within about 30 minutes, I'm going to be a DJ. Simple as that. And it was kind of weird because in the same year as Tony Blackburn opened up Radio 1, which was pure pop, I was also with school friends watching Jimi Hendrix at the De Montfort Hall in Leicester. So I had this sort of credibility thing where I wanted to be really hip, as most 16-year-olds in that era did. But at the same time, I was pure pop. So there was a fantastic sort of imbalance that I've had all my life throughout all of my broadcasting as well. But it was a terrific moment. It was flower power. I mean, that was mind-blowing at the best of times. And then you put Tony Blackburn on top of it, and the whole thing was just a revolution. And I just thought it was sensational. Because I was brought up and lived in the Midlands, so we didn't get the benefit of Radio Caroline or Radio London, which were Manchester and London-based. So my entire early radio experience was listening to Radio Luxembourg. And my father built me a little crystal set, which they're an absolute collector's piece now. And I'd listen to it under my pillow at night. And I even took that to school with me and did that obviously illegally. But I was actually fixated on radio, but I didn't realise why. I just thought it was pure entertainment until I heard Tony Blackburn actually talk to me. Because with Luxembourg, the whole signal just flowed in and flowed out and you could never hear it. It was ironic that I actually finished up working at Radio Luxembourg first prior to joining Radio 1. The 16-year-old wanted to be a DJ, so spent the next 2 years preparing for this great big coming of the mighty airwaves. I managed to get a job at the age of 18 on BBC Radio Birmingham, which was one of the new BBC local radio stations. And to my absolute horror and shock, not only did they employ me, but they asked me to do the opening show and the breakfast show. And I hadn't got a clue what I was doing. I'd never done it before, literally. I hadn't got a clue. So I finished up opening Radio Birmingham on the 9th of November in 1970, at the age of 18. And ploughed through that to the best of our ability, which was quite an interesting process, because in those days BBC local radio only had about 10 hours needle time, which was playing commercial records in effect for the whole week, and the rest of the playlist was made up of library music and stuff that was unrecognizable, had no name, and was of no relevance. So how on earth we managed to get a single listener, I don't know. It must have been through the traffic reports, whatever. But anyway, enjoyed that. And then I was very lucky to get a call from a friend who was working up in London, who was in the promotions business, and he got me an interview with an agent called Mary Titmus. I'll never forget meeting her for the first time. Most frightening experience, other than interviewing Hugh Cornwell from The Stranglers, the most terrifying experience of my life. But met Mary Titmus, and she sort of sat on a dais and looked at me and said, "Well, I think Radio 1 are looking for some new DJs to do some shows, and I think you'll do one." And I went, okay. So I went along and auditioned, and I got the job to be part of a batch of new kids called Radio 1's Second 11. And we were doing Saturday mornings for 2 hours. And I did 8 shows, I think. And I was handing over to Emperor Roscoe at that time. And that was fantastic. The guy I've been listening to for so long. Anyway, those flashed by and I heard nothing more. But on the back of that, I managed to get an interview with a wonderful man called Ken Evans, who was the program director at Radio Luxembourg, and he kindly gave me a job, and I flew out to Luxembourg, and I did about 4 or 5 years at Luxembourg, and had a whale of a time. It was a brilliant experience. And then the call for Radio 1, long expected, long hoped for, long prayed for, and then it came, and that minute changed my life forever. The one and only Doreen Davis, the Doyen, she is the most extraordinary one. I still see her. We still have lunch together. She's still as bright as a button, full of passion and energy and determination. Just a remarkable lady who saw potential. I think more in my case, she saw the energy and the enthusiasm and the love of the whole process. What I didn't have was all the music credibility to go with it. And that is where we go back to the whole process of my career at Radio 1, which was this sort of fantastic boxing match between pure pop entertainment and desperately trying to be credible, because that was the big thing at the time. But she gave me a break, and I was renting a flat in the Barbican in London, working on Luxembourg, and I waited 3 days, having done the auditions and having been told, we'll get in touch with you, because it was a weekend, classic. Do it on the Friday, don't get to know anything on the Monday, until the Monday. And then the call came through about 6 o'clock in the evening, and I was with a friend, and he says to this day, I literally lifted from the floor and hit my head on the stucco roof of the flat, and I'm sure I still got the holes in the top of my head. That's how high I jumped with joy, and it was an extraordinary moment, and I was given a job, and the next thing, it was just like a blur. I left Radio Luxembourg, I was in London, I think I was introduced to the audience on Top of the Pops. I cannot remember, for the life of me, I cannot remember my first show, I cannot remember my first record, I can't remember any of that. It's all still a blur. A 10-year Radio 1 career, 77 till 88. And during that time, I was lucky enough to be able to engage the TV producers to use me as well. So that helped a lot in terms of, you know, building up the profile to remain sort of in the game. And I did Top of the Pops every month for 10 years. One of the longest serving Top of the Pops DJs, I think. And unbelievably, they are still showing the shows as we speak, which is highly embarrassing because I had hair then, you know. Alas, not so much now. But the Top of the Pops supported Radio 1, Radio 1 supported Top of the Pops, and the two brands put together made Radio 1 into this phenomenal sort of entertainment battleship. It was huge, way beyond anything I ever dreamt or imagined it would be like in terms of the public relationship and the whole the communication that you had with the public was a tsunami of people and letters, and we didn't have texts, didn't have emails. It was good old fashioned writing, and there were thousands and thousands of requests coming in every day, and it just absolutely gobsmacked me, really, when you consider how much trouble people went to get their name mentioned on the radio. And that did give you quite a sense of responsibility. And I used to worry about it. I didn't want to miss out on anybody. I wanted to try and say hello to everybody who wrote in, until producers strapped my mouth up and said, actually, you need to play some music. The ten year career at Radio 1 peaked without any shadow of doubt at tea time. It was a dream to get that show. I'm not good in the mornings, although I finished my career at Radio 1 in the mornings. And as people used to say, they used to literally listen just to see if I was awake or not. But tea time worked well for me. because as soon as I did my tea time show, I'd go off and do a gig somewhere in Huddersfield or in Norwich or wherever. The tea time show, I think, did actually manage to create quite an identity of its own. And I think the reason for it is because it was a fantastic time for music, because the new romantic era was clashing with the punk era, so that was like exciting anyway. Also, for me, it was perfect because it was pure pop daytime radio, but I was trying to bring some credibility into it. So we were always sort of a little bit edgy against the system of daytime strip shows, and sort of leaning a little bit more further towards sort of Kid Jensen and John Peel, but not being allowed to go the whole way. So on the Tea Time show, I could do some introduction to some new acts and some new music. And the two that I'm probably most proud of are Duran Duran and Spandau Ballet, who actually started their broadcasting careers, if I'm right, and they may say I'm wrong, but I think, by doing sessions for my radio show before they were signed to record companies. And the same happened to a number of other bands, including most notably Culture Club, who weren't even Culture Club at that time. So I get all these tapes in from all these bands from all over the place, and we listen to the tapes and we go, yeah, that sounds okay, let's put them in the studio, let's do a session with them. And we played it live on the Tea Time show, and that really did begin to sort of open up quite an interesting phase for music, because there was definitely new music coming out of daytime on Radio 1, and I was really chuffed with that. The new romantic era was definitely, well, as we know now, I mean, as we sit here in 2017, the 80s revival is still a phenomenon. So, it's pretty impressive, the legacy that was left. But it was so colourful. I mean, most of the acts, really, I always thought that actually a lot of them were playing music as a means to show off their fashion. And to a degree, I'm sure there was a certain amount of truth in that. But it worked. It was pure pop with a real sort of it was visionary in its feel. New romantic music had a definite sort of buzz to it, had a definite character. But it was all the same chord structures of everything else you've ever heard in pop, really. But it was the way it was portrayed, and also the lead singers were critical because they had to be above the law, literally, and they had to be. It was a spectacle. That's the best way to describe it, a spectacle. But then you put that against the punk thing that was happening. So one minute I was going down to the 100 Club in Oxford Street to see the very first Sex Pistols gig, which was a buzz, to say the least, or going to the Roundhouse in Camden. And the next minute I'd be going to one of the new romantic nightclubs to watch a pop show. So I think it was exciting because there was no norm. Well, to cut a long story short, was picked up from the Radio 1 session and became the first hit for Spandau, so I was chuffed about that. The same thing happened with Duran Duran, I think. So Adam Ant, Duran Duran, Spandau Ballet, Simple Minds, gosh, even U2, I think. I can't remember exactly, but so many of those acts sort of got their first exposure. Through the Tea Time show. And Adam Ant's mum used to send me a Christmas card every Christmas, which I thought was brilliant marketing, absolutely brilliant marketing. I couldn't believe it. And she still sent me Christmas cards even after I'd left Radio 1, which is kind of cute. So hello to her. But it was exciting because one of the most significant moments for daytime meets nighttime radio, because there was always this sort of, you know, us and them, which was crazy, really, but it existed, was the time when I was listening to John Peel, and I heard him play a record by a band called The Undertones from Ireland, and it was a track called Teenage Kicks, and I listened to this on his show, and I just went, oh my God, that has got to be one of the most exciting records I've ever heard in my life. And the next morning, it hadn't been distributed by promoters or anything for us to sort of, you know, review and decide we want to play it or not. I actually made that important move and went to John Peel's office, which I'd never been to before. You just didn't enter there. And I asked him if he would lend me the copy of Teenage Kicks by The Undertones for me to play on my Tea Time show. And he sat back and